Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ed Schenck, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing with terrestrials. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ed a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ed Schenck about fly fishing with terrestrials. Front Range Angler is a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Well, before we introduce Ed, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Ed's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder. And that gift certificate can be redeemed in their store or online on their website. So here's how you win that. You must be the first person to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. Now, the question will be about something Ed and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win. Our guest speaker tonight is Ed Schenck. Ed Schenck has fished since the age of 2 or thereabouts, caught his first trout at the age of 7. He has fished the Latorte ever since. Ed has also fished the West, including Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho for the past 36 years, as well as streams in New Jersey, New York, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, and South Dakota. He has fished the famous streams of Argentina 4 times. His best Argentine trout was a 29-inch, 9-pound brown, which was taken on a Schenck sculpin from the famous Boca Pool of the Chimayun. Ed has tied flies for 65 years, tying commercially for most of that time. He originated the Latorte cricket, the flat-wing Latorte hopper, Schenck crest bug, Schenck sculpin, popularizing the dub-looping or fur chenille method. He was the first to trim these fur-loop tied flies to specific shapes, such as the flat oval of the Schenck crest bug. He also originated the Schenck minnow and the double trico. He has been a fishing instructor for Allenberry, Inc., Latorte Limited, Orvis Allenberry Fly Fishing Schools, and the fishing instructor under Joe Humphreys at Penn State. Ed has fished with various dignitaries, including William Conrad, Governor Ray Schaefer of Pennsylvania, and tied flies for President Jimmy Carter, and also fished with the late Joe Brooks. Ed has written over 50 articles for the following magazines: Sports Afield, Field and Stream, Fly Fisherman, Fly Fisher, Trout, Pennsylvania Angler, Fly Fishing Heritage, Fly Rod and Reel, American Angler, American Fly Tire, and Mid-Atlantic Fishing Guide. Ed published the book Fly Rod Trouting in 1989, which was released as a hardback edition and later as a paperback. He also released a VHS video in 2000, Ed Schenck, Master of the Latorte. This video shows tying and fishing 5 of his patterns: Schenck sculpin, Schenck minnow, Schenck crest bug, Latorte cricket, and Schenck Latorte hopper. Well, Ed, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be on the line with you.
Well, that's a long introduction, and I even cut some of it out. But I guess there's a lot to say about someone that's fished as many years as you've fished.
Well, I'm past middle age, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Well, let's dig in. We've got a lot to talk about. A lot of good questions came in on the show. I want to thank all our listeners for putting those questions in. We always appreciate those because that's what really makes our show. So it's good to have those. And we've got a couple others here. I'm just checking here on the Internet, and a few have come in since the show started. So be sure to type any in on our homepage in that text box if you want to ask a question, and we'll try to get them answered. Okay, so, Ed, let's just start out. What are terrestrials? Define terrestrials for us.
Well, this is a word that Charlie Fox coined for land-based insects that happen to get into the water, such as ants, beetles, crickets, hoppers, things like that. Go ahead.
And are those like caterpillars or things like that?
Oh, absolutely. Anything that even people, I guess, up in the water would be considered a terrestrial.
Yeah, down in the Amazon with piranhas, right?
That
would work out just fine there. And when did fly fishers first start using terrestrials for fly fishing?
I just have a feeling that, that's a sort of a hard question to answer, but I have a feeling that ever since they began fly fishing, they've imitated certain things like house flies and things like that. But basically, back in the 1930s is when we became more cognizant of these different patterns.
Okay. And when did you start using terrestrial? Do you remember?
Back in the 1930s. As a matter of fact, and this will probably answer something from some of the questions later on, but the first terrestrial that I used, and actually the first one I ever tied as a little boy, was a hard-bodied ant. And they were used, especially on the Latorte, but it was well-known on some of the other creeks, Penn's Creek and Spring Creek and so on and so forth. But that really was one of the first ones that I ever used.
And hard body meaning that, I assume, it was subsurface?
It's a sinking job. Surprisingly enough, and this is going to answer a question from later on, that particular insect or that particular fly, we started using it at the beginning of the season in April and fished it right straight through till the end of the season. At that time, our season in Pennsylvania ended in July. And it was fished more strictly as a wet fly, down and across a lot. But even as a boy, I can even still picture a couple fish that I raised and took by fishing it upstream and having it come back to me. Well, like a drowned ant.
Yeah, okay. Well, Rick from Michigan wants to know, what your favorite terrestrial is?
Well,
in particular?
You know, since I originated the Latorte cricket, I think that has to be my favorite. I like a lot of the other ones, but that's my pet.
The cricket, is that a seasonal type terrestrial, or is that something you'd fish all the time too?
Well, it really is. Real crickets are right now beginning to develop and don't really get to be mature until a little later in August, but we fish them even early in the season. Who are we to say what the fish take them for? You know what I mean? You might say, well, I'm fishing a cricket, but the fish might say, well, that's a black caddis or what have you, so it's hard to tell. As long as they catch fish, we don't worry about them.
We don't worry about it. You said when the crickets mature, so do crickets every year, do they come from eggs or something? Does it take them summer to mature?
You got me.
Okay. I just raised a question. I never thought about that.
They just start as you see the tiny little brownish crickets jumping around. And if you're a lawnmower like I am, and then a little later as you mow, you'll see big crickets jumping ahead of the mower.
Right. I guess the same thing with grasshoppers as well, is that...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, I noticed there's a question here about, and I don't know, do you fish for bass, smallmouth, largemouth?
I, I have fished for them many times over the years, but I really haven't lately. But there again, I would go to a slightly larger cricket, and instead of fishing it on a dead drift, I'd fish it as it drifted and twitch it every so often, like a regular bass bug.
Okay. We also... Go ahead.
Go ahead. It is effective. It's I've got a good number of bass, large and smallmouth, on it.
Now, I have a question that came in on the Internet that's from Joanne in St. Louis Obispo, California, and she's talking about largemouth and smallmouth bass. She wants to know, besides hoppers and crickets, do you recommend any particular terrestrials for bass?
Well, actually, an almost terrestrial is a frog, really. You know, even though they're an amphibian and everything, but not so much, because most of the other ones are designed as smaller flies, and crickets and hoppers, you can dress them pretty large, and which I think makes them a little more attractive to largemouth and smallmouth.
Make a bigger meal for them, right?
Yep, yeah.
Now, you just mentioned the frog. I guess a... You know, I went out in the dictionary and looked up terrestrial, and it says any basically land-based, you know, animal or insect. It basically means land-based.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess you could throw a mouse in there, too, and that would work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Work for the largemouth.
I've tied a number of meese or what have you, and had out of deer hair. And they work very well. I hadn't even thought of that. I've sort of gotten away from the bass fishing lately, so, but that's a good thought.
We had a question come in on the Internet just now from Dennis in Ford, I guess, Ford York, or Dennis Ford York is maybe his name. What is your favorite size cricket? Is there a particular size hook you tie those on?
Well, if basically I tie those in the Latourde hopper in size 12, 14, and 16. And sometimes a little smaller, sometimes a little larger. But I would say on both the cricket and the hopper, a 14 is the one I fish with more than any.
Okay, okay. Let's talk a little bit about seasons. And you've kind of addressed this a little bit already, but Joe Riolo, sorry I destroyed your name, Joe. Marcy, New York.
Riolo.
Riolo, okay, okay. What time of year can you fish terrestrials? Are there some daytimes that are better than others? So he's asking time of year as well as time of day, I guess.
Well, I would say that essentially I start thinking more of terrestrials about mid-May and then on through till the frost hits and then some. But time of day, it varies. I used to love to be on the water at daylight. I'm getting too old to get up early. I hate it. I hate it with a passion now. It really is. And so I don't get out there that early anymore. But the early morning fishing is good. But you can, on particular streams, you can catch fish any time of the day.
You said early morning is good. Is there a particular reason for that, do you think?
Yeah. This is only a theory, but I think the fish have had time to quiet down. Some of them have, the bigger fish especially, have become night feeders. And early in the morning, they've done most of their feeding. They're ready to take a last gulp or two before they find a hiding spot for the day. And so, not only small, but large. And I have a story about one a little later. It was an early morning fish. One of the few times a couple years ago that I did force myself to get out pretty early.
Ed, you're missing half the day if you don't get up, you know, like at 4 or 5 in the morning like I do. So.
Yeah, but I've just done it too many years. Get the fish from dawn till dark and then some. But
Yeah, enough is enough, huh?
Right.
We've got a question. I'm going to say it because you've kind of addressed it, but Bob K. in Flushing, Michigan says, there's a legendary Michigan steelheader who brought grasshopper imitations for opening day. He mashed them before using and was embarrassingly successful. A friend has caught rainbow trout on foam rubber ladybugs in all 12 months. Is there really no best time to use terrestrials? And I guess
there's still a better time.
There's still a better time.
If you're, and I use this word loosely, but if you're stupid enough to fish in the wintertime, why, go at it. But I have a feeling, I don't know about whether these rainbow trout were stream-bred fish or whether they're a hatchery fish. But plopping anything on the water, whether it's a rubber ladybug or what have you, is going to be attractive to a hatchery fish because that's where his food came from. So that has a lot to do with it.
So, so if you're catching a lot of 10 or 12 inchers and they just stock the stream the week before, you know why, right?
Yeah, he could be using foam rubber, some other kind of bugs too, and probably be doing the same thing. Now, if they happen to be orange ones, why, they could be a rainbow might think it's a floating egg, salmon egg. It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the guy fished them, you know. He might fish them under like a glow bug, we call them, the egg patterns.
Yeah, it's no telling what they take it for. Well, I guess that's kind of the way with terrestrials, too. I mean, are the trout and or bass, I mean, are they really being that selective for terrestrials, or are they just looking for a good meal?
Mainly looking for a good meal. A good many of the terrestrial surface feeders are, they're taking anything that comes in their range. You know, there might be ants, or it might be tiny beetles, or it might be maybe a bigger cricket or a hopper once in a while, but they'll take them all if they're not disturbed. So they're not too selective.
Okay, well, we have to take a quick break here, Ed, but when we come back, we'll talk with you more about fly fishing with terrestrials.
Very good.
Okay. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop is an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ed Schenck about fly fishing with terrestrials. If you'd like to ask Ed a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Ed, I want to just take a minute here before we jump back in here, because I do have some follow-up questions on what you just said. But tell us a little bit about, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing life nowadays, and are you still involved with the business as well as the hobby?
Well, yeah, I still tie a fair number of flies for Harry Murray down in Edinburg, Virginia. Now, Harry's well known, and he advertises in, I'm going to mention his name a little later, too. He advertises in most of the fly fishing magazines, and I tie crickets, hoppers, and crow beetles for him.
Isn't he a smallmouth guy?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he wrote a book on smallmouth or something.
Oh, yeah, a couple of them. But he's a good trout fisherman, too. He's fished the West quite a bit, but I think lately he's dealt more with the smallmouth fishing.
Okay. So you're tying flies for him, and what else are you up to?
Well, taking naps in the afternoon sometimes.
Nothing wrong with that.
And we had, unfortunately, our local shop had to close because they just, well, it just wasn't cost effective. But it got to the point that I was down there a couple hours every morning drinking their coffee. Of course, they, you know, if I didn't show up, what's the matter? Are you sick or whatever? So I almost felt obligated a lot of times, and dispensing a little bit of information once in a while and things like that.
Well, aren't you still teaching classes and so forth?
Yeah, we have. I teach with Joe Humphreys at Allenberry Incorporated, which is on the Yellow Breaches, and we do about five schools a year. Other than that, I don't do any guiding anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That became too cost-effective with the guiding license and insurance and so on and so forth. And for the one or two times that I would do it, I just it would break even, so it wasn't worth it. Plus the fact that at my age, I hate to say it, but I wear out a little quicker than I used to.
Now, what kind of classes do you teach at Allenbury?
Well, they're actually fly fishing classes, the standard beginner stuff, the casting and knot tying, and then on the stream fishing with nymphing, dry fly, and streamer techniques.
Okay. So generally more towards the starting fly fisher than the more experienced?
Yeah, but actually we have a number of people that want a little fine-tuning, so to speak, on
mm-hmm.
certain things, you know, that we get beginners, rank beginners, and people that have fished for a number of years. And even myself and Joe, I'm sure Joe has learned from me, and I've definitely learned from him.
Great, great. And folks, if you want to learn more about that, Allenbery does have a website. It's allenberry.com, allenberry.com, so you can
right.
find out about Ed's classes and Joe Humphrey's as well there.
We have one left, one in August, and that'll be it for the year then.
Great, great. Folks, you can find out more there at the website and take Ed up on a few lessons there. Good. Well, going back to our terrestrials, you know, we're talking about fish taking them more opportunistically. What happens during a hatch? You know, you're in the morning and you've got a hatch going on. Do you fish the hatch? Are you ever successful with terrestrials during a hatch?
Well, I've done both. I've done the western fishing, the so-called gulpers on the Madison with the tricos, and most of the time, once in a while, I'll fish one called a double trico, which is two tricos tied on a slightly larger hook. In other words, they're literally mating. But I've caught just as many on a cricket, to tell the truth, not only on the Madison, but other rivers, too, that have the hatches. After so many years, I'm getting away from the 6X and 7X and the tiny, tiny flies.
Much easier to tie on a cricket, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as long as they take it, why, I'm not going to argue with them.
Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, he asks, how long after the height of the terrestrial season are they still effective for fish? I've heard various time periods of, and he puts in quotes, fish memory from a couple weeks to months. Or do you think that makes any difference at all?
Not mostly, because you're going to run into some sort of terrestrial from literally fairly early spring, clear in through the summer and into the fall. The only one that I can really think of is the cicada, the so-called 17-year locust, which I've had the opportunity to fish. Of course, there's many different broods of that, and that's a big locust. And probably at least 2 or 3 weeks after the hatch is over, I've still caught fish on it. So they do have some sort of a memory.
Now, I got a question in here on the Internet from J.D. Elmer in Canton, New York. He says, what style hook do you prefer tying grasshoppers on? I suppose cricket's the same, huh?
Actually, I still use, basically, I use the, my mind went blank. That happens every so often. But the Norwegian hooks, yet.
Mustads?
Yeah. Mustads, yeah. Yeah, I have to tell you a quick story here. I guess we
sure.
had one of the times that I had flown to Argentina, I had a little problem making connections once I got to Buenos Aires, and I happened to recognize a person on a cell phone that in Argentina that I had met, and I asked him, well, quote, what the hell's going on, you know? He said, well, there's no radar at the little Chapalco airport, so we're going to change and go to Bariloche. So I said, well, would you mind if I tag along? He said, no. So I tagged along, you know, and when we got down there, why, he said, and he had already called his ranch foreman to notify my friend, Baby Anchorina, that I was going to be delayed. And he said, I'm sorry, but I'd take you along back up the Junin de los Andes, but we don't have any room in the fellow that's going to pick us up. So finally came over, he said, if you don't mind sitting on the with the luggage, why, we can take you. It was about a 100-mile drive. So anyhow, we got in this Land Rover, and the driver drove like he was on the Le Mans, you know, blew the horn, get the heck out of the way, peons, and, you know. And so it was a pretty hairy ride, but it was okay. And we got almost to the little town where I would have to turn off, and there was my friend waiting for me. And so he'd gotten a message. So at any rate, in introductions and everything, I was introduced to the driver, and I didn't catch a name, but he said, well, make sure you use must-stand hooks. I said, oh, I do most of the time. And when he left, I said to my friend, who the heck was that? He said, that was Uli Mustad. O.F. Mustad himself, you know, which, you know, I thought, boy, isn't this a small world, you know.
Interesting.
That was great. On with the program.
Yeah, out in the middle of nowhere, and you never know. So you use Mustad, but what style hook do you use?
Long
shank, or?
Actually, the 9671, which is really considered a nymph hook, but it's actually with the deer hair and everything on the hopper and the cricket, it still makes a good floater. Otherwise, on some of the other terrestrials, I use just standard dry fly hooks.
Okay. We've got some more questions here on flies. One just came in here on the Internet. That question is from Denison, York. Is the Jacet pattern still an effective fly in Pennsylvania streams?
Yeah, it's called a Jacet.
Jast.
So you pronounced it pretty close. I'll tell you a quick story on that. When that Joe Brooks wrote about it first, and which he's the one that really brought Charlie Fox and Vince Marinaro into the limelight, and he had written about that fly. And, of course, the article came out in the wintertime, and, of course, the fly is definitely a late summer fly to imitate the little leafhoppers and everything. So before the opening of the season, I was tying more flies in, and I got calls for Jacets and Jaspers and everything but Jacets, but I knew what they wanted, and I tied them, and the guys ran out and put split shot on and fished them on opening day and couldn't catch a damn thing on them, and figured, well, they're no good, you know, but it is still a fun fly to fish with.
Are those little green?
Well, the actual leafhoppers are green, but the Jacet, of course, is tied with a jungle cock nail, a jungle cock eye, tied flat over the body. But I've tied them completely green and everything, but the leafhopper comes in all different colors. Green, brown, what have you. It's just tiny, that's all. It's one fly that I never really used a heck of a lot. But it's still a good change of pace every once in a while. Show them something they haven't seen, especially on these fish that are fished over day after day after day, which is what we get around this area, down on the Yellow Breaches.
Now, it looks like that's a fly you fish topwater, right?
It's
got a lot of hackle on
floater.
It. Yep. Okay, Tom Murray, it's kind of a long thing that he wrote here in Pooler, Georgia. But I think this will get some conversation going on materials on tying flies. Foam has become the most popular material used in making terrestrials, yet foam terrestrials don't perform as well as those tied using traditional materials because they don't die and drown. For example, foam ants do not attract or catch as many fish as non-foam ants that will die and sink below the water's surface. The same holds true for hoppers and beetles. Foam terrestrials do not behave like real bugs, yet foam is all we can seem to find in the shops. Foam patterns are all I can find in books and magazines. Where can I go to find non-foam patterns? So there's a lot you can talk about there.
Well, I can make it easy for the guy. He has a last name that is the same as Harry Murray's, and Harry does sell my crickets and hoppers, like I'd mentioned before, and also the crow beetle, which is named after a gentleman by the name of John Crow, C-R-O-W-E, which is deer hair. And Harry also has some variations of the, I think one of these is mentioned later on, but variations of the beetles and everything that he calls a flying beetle, which are non-foam. I am in the process, running it through my mind a lot. I'm mentally lazy anymore on writing, but when I decide to sit down and write, I can write an article in about a day and a half, and because I've done it in my head so many times. But I do want to, and I hope this isn't going to infringe on your outfit here, but I'm going to call it, and these guys can look for this sometime in the next year, call it Tried and True Terrestrials. And it will be the old style, which I grew up with, the crickets and the hoppers and the ants and beetles and inchworm, and they're all non-foam. Now, I have used, the only foam pattern that I've ever used with some success was a foam beetle, but I prefer the deer hair beetles. They don't last as long, but I like tradition, too, and I'm not too crazy about stuff like Chernobyl ants and things like that.
So you tend to lean more towards the natural materials for your crickets and hoppers?
Yeah, absolutely. I've just done that so many years and everything, and they catch fish, and that to me, that's the main thing. And I don't want to see them die out. You know, this is one thing to me that's important. It's just like this Tom Murray says, that foam has become the most popular material, blah, 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 you know. Blame that on acquaintance Harry Steeves and his book on foam flies. And when Harry and I get together, I give him a little bit of H-E-double-L. all this junk, you know, but to catch fish. You know, to some people, that's all that matters. But like I say, I'm a traditionalist, too, and I like a little bit of the history of the sport in there also.
Well, I think...
go ahead.
I was just going to say, for Tom's benefit, too, there's, in a lot of the fly tying books, there's the old patterns of hoppers and crickets that are all tied naturally. He shouldn't really have any problem finding patterns for those.
Right. I know that Umquist still sells my hopper, I believe. I'm not sure. I don't know why they dropped the cricket or one or the other. I'd get a little bit of a royalty from them, but I've noticed that if this gentleman would get Murray's catalog, and he's pretty close there, he's in Georgia, that's not too far from Virginia, so Harry would be able to accommodate him, but a number of the other ones. Cabela's have some of them, and some of these other outfits, too. So,
and I think for Tom's benefit as well, if you just go out on the Internet, you can find almost any recipe out on the Internet nowadays.
I would say so,
just searching for them.
Yeah, just jump in here. I don't have it in DVD, and this is going to answer a question that came up a little later, but I do still have a video out. And I didn't name it. It's called Ed Shank, Master of the Latourette. I don't like giving myself great names, you know. I just enjoy fishing. But at any rate, it's tying and fishing the cricket, the hopper, my crest bug, and the shank minnow and the shank sculpin.
Oh.
And about 50% tying and 50% fishing. Not too much catching. See? Every time I hooked a big fish, the cameraman wasn't ready, and when he was ready, the damn thing got off. One of those things. But
so where could one get one of those?
Harry Murray still sells those.
Harry Murray, okay.
I have to send him a couple right now. I have them on the table ready to mail to him. And
okay.
If the people would happen to come to fish the Yellow Breeches, why, the Yellow Breeches Outfitter still sells a few. They're about 5 miles from me. That's they're the only two that I know of that, you know, everybody has gone to DVDs and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And, folks, just for your information, Murray's Fly Shop, Harry Murray's website is murraysflyshop.com, Murray's plural, murraysflyshop.com. So you can get Ed's video there if you want to learn how to tie with natural materials and so forth. So. Good. I'm glad you brought that up. That'd be very helpful to Tom here. So,
as a matter of fact, just before we connected here, I had a call from a fellow that wanted me to instruct him on the stream, which I refused. Again, I don't like to do that, but about fishing the non-terrestrial, the Shank-Sculpin.
Oh.
And I did mention to him that part of that would be shown in that video, and I mentioned Harry Murray, and he said he buys a lot of flies from Harry. So that was something else there, you know, just a couple minutes before we started to talk.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break again, but we'll return in a few minutes and talk to Ed more about fly fishing with terrestrials. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service, is located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan, providing year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit them at www.pmlodge.com. That's PM for Pere Marquette, pmlodge.com. Or call them at 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ed Shank about fly fishing with terrestrials. If you'd like to ask Ed a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's see what we've got here coming in on the Internet. And, Jim Moser in West Virginia wants to know, have you found better materials to use than the original recipes for the cricket and the hopper? And I'm assuming he's talking about the Latorte, the ones that he developed.
Yeah, the only change in materials would be the body material. I use the super fine dry fly dubbing. Now, instead of the originals were Angora yarn, spun, you know, wax thread and then spun. And I've gone to super fine. Other than that, everything else is the same. Goose quill, or if you can't get the broad goose quills, I do some turkey hunting too, and a lot of the wild turkeys don't have the nice mottled wing quills that you can buy, but they do die very, very well and very quickly. All you have to do on these broad turkey quills, the wing quills, are soak them up first and dip them in black dye, of course, for the crickets, and you dip them and shake them around for 10 seconds and pull them out and rinse them off, and you have as black a pattern or black a wing as you ever want. So okay. I use those quite a bit when I can't get the goose quills.
Okay, good. Question from Ron McCusick in Corina, Maine. Are the female insects more important to feeding fish than males? When we tie the feet...
Yeah, I think the female is more important to the male than it is to the fish.
Okay.
But I'm trying to picture the only thing that really has nothing to do with the terrestrials, because most of those, unless you're an entomologist, you wouldn't recognize the male or female because they don't have an egg sac per se. But
okay.
He wants to know here that what color the egg sacs are, and that varies on mayflies. It varies from probably a sort of a golden orange to pale yellow. Some of the caddis have a green egg sac, and they can be important on those, but not really for terrestrials.
Okay. Jeff K. in Collegeville, Pennsylvania asks, Ed, do you weight your shank sculpin? Sometimes I think the splash can spook fish, especially in the Latorte, but I've also had the opposite happen.
Well, there again, I could refer him to changing the page here. In case people don't know it, you gave me a page of questions here from these people, so I had a chance to study them. I'm sure that's not illegal or anything.
No.
I could do it off the cuff without, but this helps a lot. Yes, I weight the shank sculpin. I put a BB size, only a BB, BB size split shot on the leader right at the eye of the hook, right in front of the clinch knot or whatever you use. And I make sure, since It does have a deer hair head. I make sure I soak the fly good, you know, squeeze it like a sponge. But with that split shot, if you don't make the head too bulky, that'll take it down pretty good. Yeah, it can spook fish if you land it right on top of a fish. But you don't try to do that, Jeff. You get it up ahead of the fish. And one other thing, you don't pull it toward the fish directly like the fly is going to attack it, because that can scare the heck out of them at times, too.
Sure.
But the splash doesn't really spook the fish unless you're plopping it right on the fish's head. And even a tiny fly that'll make a splash, if a tiny split shot makes a splash, the fish will spook. And again, especially in the Latorte and other streams like it.
Do you use a lot of head cement or super glue, or what do you do to make your flies more durable?
Well, not really a heck of a lot. I've watched one of Dave Whitlock's videos on tying the Whitlock hopper, and it probably takes a half an hour to tie one because he glues every turn of the thread, literally. No reflection, Dave. You know, we're speaking acquaintances. But no, and I'll tell you here again another story. One of my favorite patterns for Argentina was the Latorte hopper. The cricket would work as well, but if the hopper's working, why go to the cricket, you know? Even though that was my favorite. And one of the days that my friend Baby and I, now Baby has passed away. He was a famous Argentine fly fisherman. But we stopped and he said, now I'm going to take you to one of my favorite little, quote, hot spots. So we went upstream a little and there was a lot of, there's willow bushes down there that actually extend out over and then down into the water so that they make a heck of a good cover, good hiding spot for fish. And right below that, of course, is sort of a dead spot. So anyhow, I caught a couple fish in this one place, two or three on a little number 16 hopper. And he said, now this isn't the really hot spot. He said, now you go on up to the next willow bush, which is about 100 yards up. He said, I'll just go out into the river here and fish. And so I did, and I kept the same hopper on. I don't know how many fish I caught. Some of them were in the five-pound class. The Shimoian River is a big river there, and these fish would get out in the current. And my arm was pretty tired, but after a while, my friend hollered, Ed, time to go eat. Now, he had servants and everything, and so they had a schedule, you know. So anyhow, when I got back to him, he said, my God, Ed. He said, I was watching you. He said, you must have landed 30 fish up there. I said, well, I wasn't really counting them, Baby. But anyhow, I still had the same fly on, so figure that I caught maybe 40 fish on that one, not just one pattern, but one individual fly. And
wow.
It was still fishable. So really, you don't need a lot of head cement to hold them together. If you're a good tire and tie them snugly enough, a little bit of head cement on the finished thread is about all I put in.
Okay. Are there any special tying techniques you can share with us that apply to terrestrials? Is there anything that you do differently than...
Well, I'll tell you, the only thing, the one difficulty that you would have, and that I have, is finding deer hair that is relatively short and thick so that when you bunch it, and the tips of it are sort of the hackles of the thing, and the butts will be trimmed for the head. But you want that as short and thick so that when you pull down on the thread, it layers up. I don't know how else to describe it. The people that use deer hair will understand that.
You're talking about short and stubby, short and thick rather than long
right.
and thin, right?
Right. Long, thin stuff just will not flare. You have to force it back into the upright position, which is a pain in the neck.
So you're saying be very selective about the deer hair you buy for
right.
tying these.
Yeah. I probably have wasted more even looking at it through the cellophane or whatever. It looks good and it sometimes just won't flare worth a darn. So when I get a piece that really flares, I literally stand up and cheer. you know, I get a big grin on my face and so forth.
It's going to be a good day of tying, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've got a couple of questions here. Dennis in York, Pennsylvania, as well as Jim Moser in West Virginia, both asking about fly rods, your choice in weight and length for fishing terrestrials. Is there something you prefer?
Well, I'm a short rod fisherman, and for many years I used a little 5.5-foot fiberglass, one-piece fiberglass rods, but I've gone actually 6 foot, 6.5 feet are the ones that I use more than any. Most of the fishing that I do are relatively short casts, and even then, if I have to, I can cast 40, 50, 60 feet with those little things, maybe more. But again, the further you cast, the slower your reaction time, you know. So I'm, like I say, I like shorter rods. But let's say any rod in the 6 to 9 feet, and I like 3-weight, 4-weight more than any for most of my terrestrial fishing.
Does that have to do with the size streams you're on, or is that just a preference whether you're on a big western stream or
a small spring creek? Little fiberglass rod. I haven't done them lately, but or the 6, 6.5 footers out on some of the big rivers of Madison and so forth in Montana, and never felt that I was undergunned, really.
Okay.
But there again, it's up to the individual. I always get the question, why do you use such a short rod, you know? And I say, well, why do you use a long rod? You hear the same recitation. Well, I can bend the fly line better and blah, blah, blah. I said, well, in other words, it's easier. Yeah. I said, well, that's why. I like a challenge. I need the challenge. If it's too easy, I'm not interested.
Touche, huh? Yeah.
And I do other things that I usually say to them if I knew them well enough to get away with, which I can't repeat over the...
Good for you. Well, we got Jeff Biller, Hunlock Creek, Pennsylvania. He says, I fish with Mr. Ed Schenck on a sulfur Saturday. The now retired owners of the Cold Spring Anglers would have people over for supper and to fish the sulfur hatch on the Latorte spring run in their backyard, and was awestruck by the effortless casting of Mr. Ed Schenck and hooking of trout. Now for his question. Do you think accuracy and presentation would be more important on a spring creek or pattern size and color, or is it 50-50 split of both?
Well, I wouldn't say it's 50-50. I would, regardless of which pattern you're using, it's if your accuracy is excellent, you have a much better chance than just blaming it on the size of the fly. Because, with terrestrials, the fish generally aren't looking for one particular. It's not like match the hatch where they're keyed in on, let's say, sulfurs or what have you. So definitely being able to get that fly within inches most of the time. I tell people, well, I usually do that. Once in a while, I think back in 1970 I made a bad cast. But, you know, people... I kid a little bit with people.
I was going to say, earlier I got the impression you were kind of a modest guy, but now I'm not too sure here. Right? So presentation is still first and foremost in your mind.
Absolutely, and the presentation plus the accuracy itself. One of the things, too, is that I don't like a dark fly line because it's hard for me to follow it once it hits the water. But for heaven's sake, and this will probably be something that we'll get into a little later, but don't make your false casts up over the fish that you're fishing for. False cast, and don't make any more false casts than you have to. One is usually plenty unless you're lengthening your cast or changing direction extremely, like 180 degrees or something like that. You might have to make a couple. But you don't want the flash of the rod. There again, we're getting into sunshine and reflections and so forth. But and you don't want that fly line to flash up over. I've noticed that up over the fish. I've noticed that the last couple of times I fished a Latorte, the fishing is not very good anymore. And the fish that are there are super, super spooky. and even having the leader, which is relatively invisible, go fairly close to a fish the other day, and I had these damn fish just taken off like I threw rocks at them or something. I saw one here, I jumped back one. They wanted to know what length and size leader I use.
Right. Henry Hager.
Yeah. And it, I tell them that Joe Humphreys uses hand-tied leaders that he has particular formula for, and he can show them why he uses them and everything. And I tell you, my basic leader is I use a needle knot for my butt section, so I have a good connection that'll slip in and out of the guides without hanging up. And I'll have that butt section about, maybe 15, 18 inches long. And then I'll take a knotless leader, knotless taper, and use a 2.5 turn barrel knot or blood knot, whatever you call it, to connect. And that could be, most of the time I use 7.5 foot leaders to start with. So now you have an 8.5 or 9 foot leader there with the butt section. Then I will go to various, let's say I buy 4X leaders. I might put 2.5, 30 inches of 5X on that. So I might end up with a 12 or 14 foot leader. So there isn't any particular length that, you know, I can't say, okay, use a 10 foot leader, use 11 foot leader, because mine varies.
Right.
And again, the leader size, I use basically with crickets and hoppers till I get down into real tiny ones, which I use occasionally. I fish 5X. If I'm using sculpins and minnows, I can, unless I'm after a particular giant fish, I'll use 4X. Because 4X now is 5-6 pound test. So back years ago, there was nylon, 6X nylon was a half pound test. So that, you know, it's a lot easier today.
Yeah.
That ought to help him a little bit.
Okay. Well, we need to take another quick break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Ed Schenk about fly fishing with terrestrials. Have you ever dreamed about classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit a website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ed Schenk about fly fishing with terrestrials. If you'd like to ask Ed a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Ed, we've got a few questions that came in on the Internet. Rick Schletta, Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. And I guess he sent in two here. And we did have some other questions that were later in the list about the Latorte. So I'm wondering if you can, what they're asking is your secrets about fishing these hard-to-fish waters and also the yellow britches, I guess. So maybe the next couple of questions you can kind of direct towards that. And then, you know, and just in general, you had started to get into it about tips on, you know, approaching fish when fishing terrestrials during the midday when the sun's up, and you talked about reflection. Can you kind of get into that more and how you approach fish on the Latorte, where they're very spooky and clear water?
Well, yeah, right. There are particular sections that like I say, believe me, I don't fish nearly as hard or as often as I used to, but there are sections of the stream that I fish at particular times of the day because of the sun's position. Mm. I don't like a sun, mainly it doesn't bother me because I use glasses, but I don't like a sun shining toward me. In other words, I'm working toward the sun because my rod flashing and most of the graphite rods now are too shiny, but that you would be surprised if you're on a stream, you watch a fisherman, if you're in a particular position, you'll see that rod flash quite often. So I try to try to gauge my position so that I'm not casting directly away from the sun, but not directly into it, so that minimizing my flashing. And also, most of the time, I take my wristwatch off, too, so that the little turning of your hand and so forth can throw some reflections onto the water. And, of course, the big bugaboo is, of course, you don't want to, early in the morning, you got to be careful because there's a long shadow, and you don't want a shadow over the fish either that's going to spook them. So you just sort of have to play it by ear, quite frankly. There's some sections of the Latorte that I fish in the morning, and I won't fish them in the afternoon because of that sun reflection or the shadows and so forth.
Well, after all these years, you ought to know each part of that river, but every inch of it in that regard, I would think, huh?
Well, it varies from year to year, too, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying that, you know, the toning down of your gear and, you know, also your clothing and all that is still very important.
Absolutely.
I know Gary LaFontaine, there was a story about Gary LaFontaine, who's now passed, but where he'd go out and buy his $600 rod, and the first thing he did was took steel wool and sandpaper and then dulled the finish on it.
Yeah.
Because he felt so strongly that that was an issue, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so, kind of a hard thing to do to your $600
rod. Yeah, I've actually painted a couple of the rods with camo paint, not camouflage, but especially green,
yeah.
You know, like green grass. And but now mainly I try to just minimize that reflection, the flashing. One of the thoughts there again is don't make any more false casts than you have to.
Right, right.
And you'll see, I'm critical to people on the stream in the sense that you'll watch one guy and we call him a fiver because he'll make five false casts before he throws every time, five. We have a couple seveners and so forth, you know. And I tell our students, you're not going to catch a fish if that flies in the air. You got to get it on the water.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, we've got some questions about presentation here. You know, how you present your terrestrials, does it differ depending on what terrestrial you're imitating? And then there was a question specifically from Chuck Campbell, Buffalo, New York, about skittering the crickets or grasshoppers or dead dristones. So maybe you could talk generally about how you present.
Well, I tell you what I normally do. Now, I've in the course of reading instructions from other fishermen, they say as soon as that hopper hits the water, give it a twitch. Because the hopper, when it hits the water, jumps a little. Well, what you're doing really is, on the cricket, is taking all the slack out of your cast, which means you're going to have a quicker drag. So what I normally try to do is the fly will generally make enough commotion when it hits the water. I don't want to splat it too heavily, but it hits the water, I make a drift, and generally when the fly's starting to drag, and I do this is a trick that you can use with any dry fly. When the fly's starting to drag, I'll give two or three tiny twitches and then drop the rod tip again. And generally what you get then is you've given life to the fly, and then you'll get another 2 or 3 feet of float before it starts to drag. And many times that is the difference between catching a fish and not catching one. So that's one of these little tricks that you don't read about too much.
No, but very simple to do and execute.
Absolutely.
It sounds like. Yeah, yeah, good tip. And so that approach is pretty much yours for the crickets, hoppers, beetles, anything floating,
well,
right?
Yeah, not so much the beetles, since they don't kick like... you know, they kick their feet, but they don't go anywhere, you know. So I don't give them that motion as much. Now, it does mention here skittering the fly. I tell you, a lot of the fishing that I did with hoppers down in Argentina, we're talking big water, big open water. I was fishing the hoppers more like a caddis. so that I was fishing them and twitching them a little and then skimming them so that I was fishing them as a caddis pattern rather than a hopper pattern most of the time. So that is, yes, I have skittered.
So it's kind of like if one thing isn't working, try something else, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I can still picture one skittering spot in a very wide river, and as the fly was skimming back, here was this, it was about a 4-inch high wave coming behind the fly. I didn't know whether to cut and run or what. But anyhow, the fish got close enough, obviously, that he saw me that was the end of it. But that was one hell of a fish, I know that. Because he was making a heavy, it was almost like pulling a log or something directly under the water, you know.
Right, just, right.
So
yeah.
That was a thrill.
Kind of like Jaws, right, coming at you.
Right.
Randy in O'Fallon, Illinois, and Kyle Ballard in Hurricane, Utah, both ask if you use a hopper-dropper combination, and specifically, do you use a copper john as a dropper?
Well, about 99 and 9/10 of the time, I do not like to fish a dropper.
Okay.
That's, I learned to fish, let's say, nymphs without a strike indicator, which if you look at 9/10 of the fly fishing shows on television, you'll see the individual throws a fly in and watches the strike indicator.
Right.
He's not really learning anything. So I'm sure this will raise eyebrows and everything. And I'll have people with signs out in front of my house here. But I very seldom, unless I'm absolutely desperate to catch a fish, I usually do not use a wet fly dropper or a nymph dropper. I don't do that very often.
Okay. Questions from Steve Clemens in Sherman Oaks, California, and Gary Powell in Memphis, Tennessee. Both ask about subsurface fishing terrestrials. I know you talked about the ant at the very beginning of the show. Are there others that you fish subsurface?
Well, I have a number of years ago, I did an article for Fly Tire magazine, I think it was. Either that or American Angler, I don't know which now, but I called it Terrestrials Top to Bottom. And I have made a couple soft-bodied crickets and hoppers, and I haven't shown this other than it's shown in, but using a dubbing loop and making a more realistic grasshopper and a cricket and fishing them with weight on the leader, you know, a split shot or two, and drifting them along the bottom. But I don't do it. I prefer, if I'm going to fish those, I like to fish on the top. But, yeah, you can even, I know when years ago, when the cricket first became public knowledge, there were a number of guys that fished it as a wet fly and caught fish on it. So you could do it that way also.
Okay, okay. I think we kind of answered the next two questions we had going here. Nick Contini in Mansfield, Ohio asks, I was told a long time ago that the best time to fish ants is early morning when you have a dew on the leaves, and I have been relatively successful with it. Now the one I have a lot of success with is fishing a hopper or other terrestrials on windy days. Am I doing something wrong? I was told to fish fly close to the bank, as this is where most of the bugs would be after being blown from the streamside vegetation. I guess he's having trouble fishing, you know, on the windy days with the terrestrials, and is there some kind of secret to that, or...?
Well, not really, and the thing of it is that he's specifically, I think, thinking about meadows or pastures. I think of that area, again, I digress. Years ago, Ted Trueblood mentioned meadow streams. He said, there's no meadow streams in the east. They're all pastures. He said, we have meadows out west, you know.
Right,
but,
right.
But anyhow, that fishing meadow or pasture streams, a good bit of the time you're trying to fish pretty close to the bank, pretty close to the weeds and everything. But I've caught fish, many fish on the Latort, fishing a cricket out in the middle between two weed beds or something like that. So you have to sort of play it by ear. And also the early morning bit is good, But a lot of the streams aren't strictly meadow streams or pastures, what have you. There are enough trees along the edge that there's going to be stuff drop in that isn't going to drop exactly along the edge of the stream.
Now, yeah, so you kind of addressed Greg Horsfield, Washington's question. He says, I have the best results for terrestrials very near stream banks or overhanging branches. Do you have any suggestions for open water use? And you've kind of just, I guess, addressed that, unless you want to say more about that, but I think you've said that either place, it's just a matter of opportunity, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, some of the streams that I've fished that have the broken water in, again, they're the fish are opportunists, and, you know, they're laying, let's say, right ahead of a submerged rock or something like that, and you plop something, even though there isn't a tree nearby, where they're gonna come up and grab it if they have a chance. They're opportunistic in a sense. You either take it now or that's tough, buddy. It's gone, you know. So.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I've many times, you know, I've been frustrated with nymphing or whatever on a day, and I put on some kind of terrestrial, and you know, and there's no fish rising or anything like that on any hatches, and it's been quite productive, and
yeah.
So. You know, I guess you never know with terrestrials, really, because there's, unless you do have something like a cicada hatch or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's well, really
even dominant. Even at times, even if there isn't a wind or something, more so, I've seen more hoppers on the water than crickets. Crickets are more apt to be dropping in along the edge, I think. But even at that, I've caught fish out on crickets out in the middle of the stream. And now my mind went blank again. I have a habit of that. I just sort of forget what we were talking about.
Go
to the next question.
Well, we're going to wind up, so this will be our last question. The time flies, but we've run out of time. But the last question I have for you is, in all the years you have fished, is there a fishing experience you had with terrestrials that stands out above all the others, a really good memory you have that you could share with us?
Okay, well, I didn't realize how late it is already. So
Ghost time flies when you're having fun, huh?
Okay. Now, I'll give you two instances, but I've told this story a number of times, but a couple years ago in July, so I decided to get up fairly early and fish the Latorte, and I caught one on a cricket, a 14 cricket, about a 14-incher, and I got to a pool that had a lot of brush and roots and so forth, and I saw a rise at the head of the pool, and I started stripping line to make the cast, and I thought, well, hey, buddy, you don't throw up there till you try the bottom of the pool. And I made a short cast. Actually, it wasn't much more than my leader, and the fly disappeared in the tiniest rise, just a little like that, and it was gone. And I said, well, you little son of a gun. And I set the hook, and the little son of a gun didn't move. And there was more to it than this, by actually keeping pressure on the fish, but not horsing it, the fish worked his way upstream, and ultimately I finally got to a place where I could land it. And it was 27 and a quarter inches. And got a good picture of it. And, you know, that was my biggest cricket fish in the Latorte.
So big fish do like crickets.
Yeah. Yep.
Good. Well, unfortunately, time to wrap things up. And this always happens. It always seems to be more to talk about and not enough time. But when we return, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And we'll also be giving away that $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stay tuned to see if you win. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united on this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's savebristolbay.org. And learn how you can get more involved. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd surely appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure that you do so for the next show. You don't want to miss out on the chances for some of these great prizes that we have to give away. Now, if you're one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So first, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And go to my database here and press my button to see who our winner is going to be for that 3-year membership. And by the way, if you want to learn more about the Federation is at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So our winner there is Roy Griffith in Pennsylvania, Roy Griffith in Pennsylvania. So Roy, if you don't have a membership, you do now, and if you do, we'll get it extended for you. So we'll contact you. So congratulations, Roy, on that membership to the Federation. Okay, now the next one is for Fly Fusion Magazine. Now, Fly Fusion Magazine is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, a beautiful magazine. And if you want to find out more about that, it's flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And the winner, hopefully I'll get the name right this time, Ed. It's Joe Riolo. So he had asked a question earlier in the show, so maybe I did a bit better on his name this time. Hey. And he's in New York. So, Joe, congratulations on winning that that subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So now we have the question I'm going to ask about something we talked about during the show. And I have to, Ed, I had to even ask the question and somebody's got the right answer. Is that fair?
I'm too good. It wasn't me, was it?
No, I hope not. You don't have a computer. The question is, and somebody anticipated, so I got to give him the prize just for anticipating it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what is your favorite size for the torque cricket? And that is what size, Ed?
Size 14.
Size 14. Well, Peter Suska in Weathersfield, Connecticut got it right. Latorte Cricket, number 14. Before I even ask the question, I must be getting very predictable, Ed. I don't know what...
I didn't tell him.
No, I know. It's just, it's kind of funny. But congratulations. And you're going to get that $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers. Now, Peter, send me... You can send it in the same text box. Send me your contact information, name, address, phone number, email address, so that we can get that out to you, that gift certificate. So, and like I said, frontrangeanglers.com, frontrangeanglers.com, you can redeem it on their online site as well. Well, Ed, we really appreciate you being with us tonight on the show. It surely was a pleasure talking with you and sharing truly a lifetime worth of experience with us. And I'm sure everybody learned a lot. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it. And I'm really surprised how quick the time went.
Oh, it does. Yeah, everybody thinks, oh, 90 minutes, well, that's a long time. But it really goes by fast.
Yeah, so. Just tell them to hang around a couple hours. I have more stories to tell them.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll have a story night sometime and just tell nothing but fish stories. That might be fun. Well, our next broadcast will be on August 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Bill Butts. And our topic for the show will be freshwater stripers on the fly. Bill Butts has made temperate basses his specialty, and freshwater stripers are one of his favorite targets. Learn Bill's secrets about finding, hooking up, and landing one of these freshwater trophies. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, Paramount Kit River Lodge, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'd be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.